You know, when you search for something on Netflix, what you get is only a fraction of what they really have? The streaming service actually has more than 18,000 titles globally, but only about 6,000 of those are available in the good old US of A. That means you're missing out on literally thousands of great shows. Unless, of course, you use ExpressVPN. ExpressVPN is an app that lets you change your online location, protecting your devices from unwanted snooping and allowing you to control where streaming services and other websites think you're located. There are over 100 different locations to choose from, which means you have access to thousands of new shows and movies no matter where you live. This doesn't just work with Netflix, it works with Disney Plus, Hulu, Max, a UK streamer called BBC iPlayer, and more. I was on a work trip in the UK during the final season of Game of Thrones, and I tried logging into my HBO account to watch a new episode, but the technology wouldn't let me because of geo-blocking. And I wish I had this app at that moment, because I now realize how incredibly easy it is to work around that problem. Here's a more recent example. It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia is not streaming on Netflix in the US, but I just fired up the episode where Dennis tries to have a peaceful mental health day, and technology keeps interrupting his plans. All I had to do was open ExpressVPN, connect to a UK server, refresh Netflix, and the show just popped up. It's super easy. I've also heard good things about that show called Billions, but I've never been a Showtime subscriber, so I've never seen it. But it's actually available right now on Netflix in South Korea, and with ExpressVPN, it took 5 seconds to switch over and start checking it out. With ExpressVPN, you get high-quality streaming from devices like your phone, laptop, tablet, and TV, and crucially, it protects your privacy and security to keep your information safe from hackers. Stop missing out on great TV and get thousands of new shows with ExpressVPN. We got them to give you all 3 extra months free when you use our special link, expressvpn.com/film. That's expressvpn.com/film to get 3 extra months completely free. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. You know that feeling when you have something that's really been bothering you, or when you've been fixating on something in your life that's looming large in your mind? We all carry around different stressors in our lives, big and small, and I think we inherently know that when we keep them bottled up inside, it can start to affect us negatively. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest, and to figure out how to work through whatever it is that's weighing you down. Therapy isn't just for people who have experienced major trauma. There are plenty of benefits it can have for everyone. It's helpful for learning positive coping skills and how to set boundaries. And don't underestimate the power of boundaries either. Those are super important. If you've been wondering if you should give therapy a try, check out BetterHelp. It's a fully online experience and designed from the ground up to be convenient and customizable to your schedule. To get started, you just have to fill out a brief questionnaire that will match you up with a licensed therapist, and you can switch therapists at any time for no extra charge. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/filmdaily today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/filmdaily.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort, meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Slash Film Daily. Today is Tuesday, May 7th, 2024. On today's episode of the show, we're going to be talking about the latest film and TV news. My name is Ben Pearson. I'm an editor at slashfilm.com, and I'm joined on today's episode by Slash Film staff writer and box office analyst, Ryan Scott.
Hey, everyone. How's it going?
All right, Ryan, you've still got that construction going on at your place, so I apologize to the listeners if any of that audio sort of bleeds through into our conversation here, but we're making do as best we can. We're trying to adapt. So
yeah, also if there's some weird crinkling, I have an ice pack on my shoulder for this episode as well, so I apologize about that.
Yeah, man, you're fending off injuries, you're dealing with noise, this is the whole thing. So let's, yeah, put our heads down and get through this the best we can. Speaking of putting their heads down, the folks at Universal, I'm guessing, probably have their heads in their hands right now based on how The Fall Guy performed in theaters in its opening weekend. Tell me about that, Ryan.
Yeah, so look, we talked about this in the summer preview episode. I just wasn't sure, and I think, you know, at that time we were talking about you know, a possible $40 million opening, which would have been fine, you know, but it still would have required this movie to leg out given its reported $130 million budget, I believe, is what it landed on after all tax incentives and stuff. And, well, it was a lot worse than that. Unfortunately, weekend estimates had it at $28.5 million, but as I just pointed out in our Slack right before the episode, it actually was only $27.7 million, so it was almost $1 million even lower than what even the weekend estimates were. So it's pretty rough, you know. Yeah, and then it made 36.7 internationally, so it's at $64.4 million globally right now. You know, this is a little less than David Leitch's previous movie Bullet Train, which you know, wasn't nearly as expensive. I mean, it was $90 million, so it's still expensive but not quite as expensive. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot to be said, obviously, but yeah, I mean, look, 27, just shy of $28 million against a $130 million budget just isn't what you want to do.
Man, this is so depressing to me, Ryan, because I loved The Fall Guy. And, you know, we talked about it in the podcast. We ran the interviews that you did with the cast on Friday's episode. I mean, it's just such a fun movie. It's just is like exactly what I want Hollywood to be doing. And now clearly Hollywood is not going to be doing more of this because the numbers just don't seem to add up here. And it like crushes my soul to see this movie perform so poorly. And like, I just don't understand because it has everything that I want in a movie. And it just makes me feel completely disconnected with wider audiences. And like, it, you know, it just is one of those things that kind of like has me reeling. So I don't know how you feel about it, like personally, or like how you feel about it in terms of what lessons the studios might learn or sort of what impact this might have on the industry.
Look up the definition of the word despondent. That's how I feel. yeah. This is a, so just for some further context, I had to do some digging and I was not the only box office analyst out there doing this, but from my calculations, this is the worst start to the summer box office since 2003 when the Lizzie McGuire movie opened. And that opened to $17.3 million. However, if you want this to get a little more depressing, if you adjust that for inflation, that gets up to $29.3 million. So even the Lizzie McGuire movie essentially had like a similar opening to The Fall Guy. You know, but then right around the corner that summer was The Matrix Reloaded, which ended up doing, you know, gigantic numbers. So we don't really have that coming right around the corner. We don't have a guaranteed $100 million opener till July.
Yeah.
You know, so look, I can start going over, you know, how depressing this is on some level. The only optimism I have is that this has an A- cinema score and reviews are good. So the people that are seeing it are really liking it. So like Elemental last year opened at $29.6 million and eventually got to almost $500 million worldwide, largely thanks to incredible word of mouth and very strong overseas numbers. Mm-hmm. So there is an outside shot that this is not over yet. The difference with animation, though, is that there's less direct competition in that space. So, you know, that makes things tricky. But I don't want to make the mistake like I did last year with Elemental of completely writing a movie off because I felt, you know, thankfully silly in hindsight on that one. Mm-hmm. However, you know, the numbers tell us this is not great. I think for me, where I'm getting stuck, like you're saying, you know, Hollywood might not make more of these. Maybe they will, because let's talk about this for a second. What's working right now? We've not had a single horror movie truly break out in a meaningful way this year yet. We have not. Superhero movies continue to be very iffy at best. You know, you're going to have your breakouts, but it's not like it was. You know, you can't make Godzilla movies forever. You're only going to get a Star Wars movie every couple of years. Not everything can be an animated family-friendly movie. So what works, Ben? You tell me what works. What do you do if you're a Hollywood studio right now?
I have no idea. And like, right. I feel like that's a huge problem.
It's a gigantic problem. It's the problem I didn't even realize I was trying to address until this weekend, where I'm like, what works? What reliably works right now? And the answer is, I don't know.
Yeah, because like last year we saw, you know, the IP plays that studios have been leaning on for what feels like decades at this point, but really is probably, I mean, I guess technically studios have been leaning on IP for a long time. Like sequels have been a thing forever and ever and ever.
Forever. People want to act like it's a recent thing. It's just, it got worse in the last 20 years, but it wasn't always that, you know, it was always a thing.
the dial has definitely been turned up significantly in the past 20 years. So like that seems to, and I don't know if, I mean, it's probably a combination of a lot of factors, including the pandemic and people being trained to watch things at home and the streaming revolution and all these things that we've been talking about in the show for the past, whatever, 5 years or something. But it's just like, it's kind of scary, man. Like, I don't know if horror and you mentioned there has not been a big horror breakout this year. And that's been something we've reliably been able to sort of count on over the past few years. And it has nothing to do with quality, because I saw The First Omen and Immaculate, and there are probably other horror movies that I'm not even remembering off the top of my head. Night Swim. These are like good movies. I mean, I actually like First Omen and Immaculate a lot more than Night Swim, but like these are good movies. It's not like the movies are bad and so Night people Swim aren't turning
did,
out.
Night Swim did fine, and I think Immaculate will do fine for Neon in the end, but you know, a $20 million horror movie isn't going to move the needle. And like to that end, another piece I wrote for us, Sony dropped Tarot in theaters this weekend. It felt like it was hardly advertised, but what I came to find out was Tarot did a purely online marketing campaign. They didn't even do billboards, no TV spots, nothing. So Sony saved a fortune probably by going that way about it. And it was only an $8 million movie. So it made 6.5, which like at a first glance looks like borderline disastrous. But truth be told, because of the minimal marketing spend and the cheap movie, it's probably going to make Sony some money in the end. But that doesn't move the needle for theaters enough to matter. And that's the thing. Like, we haven't had a Black Phone yet this year, or we haven't had an Evil Dead Rise this year. We've had some horror movies do okay relative to their budget. But, you know, so that's what's good about horror. But, you know, the problem is like, when, you know, Star Wars The Phantom Menace can debut at number 2 in re-release with $8.7 million on the first weekend of summer, that's not good. Yeah. You know, I think it's an interesting conversation to be had, and I think thank God that movie did as well as it did. And thank God that Challengers only dropped, you know, 49% and, you know, made $7.5 million on its second weekend. But, you know, I'm with you, man. I felt some optimism at certain points this year, but this weekend really made me realize, like, I don't know where, like, if you're a Hollywood studio now, what do you greenlight? Like, what do you look at and go, because The Fall Guy, 87% on Rotten Tomatoes, A- cinema score, Ryan Gosling, Emily Blunt coming off the biggest movies of their career, David Leitch, one of the most like reliable hit-making franchise directors we have going right now. They did everything right.
Yeah.
And it just didn't, you know, I'm not saying for sure it's not going to work out in the end, but it's not looking good. So I don't know. It's rough sledding, and it definitely does not inspire confidence.
Yeah, man. It's, I don't even have like a good, you know, wrap it up type of quip as we move on to the next thing.
I don't either. I just understand that like as the summer, this first month of summer goes on, month or two, there's probably going to be a little more pessimism to go around, I hate to say.
Yeah. Okay. So one person who's not focusing on pessimism is James Gunn, who is directing this new Superman movie that is supposed to be all about optimism, Ryan. And David Corenswet is playing this character. And yesterday, James Gunn released the first official like full body image of Superman. And I'm curious what you made of this, because the internet had a whole thing. I mean, everybody sort of reacted in their own way to this. But what was your take on this new look at what our new Superman looks like?
So look, I've said it before, I'm not the biggest DC guy, and I'm very specifically not really like a Superman guy. Superman often bored me to tears, but I said this, and again, it might have a lot to do with it's been over a decade, but I remember when I first saw Henry Cavill in the Superman costume, and I just remember being like, damn, that's Superman. And like, I didn't have that feeling when I saw that. I just felt nothing. And like, I love James Gunn as a filmmaker. I have every belief. Let me be very clear. I have every belief this movie's going to be good. But I just, the image did nothing for me. Like, nothing. I had the same thing that some people had where I thought it was odd that like, if you look at the top of the image where like he's leaning over and like parts of the suit are like crumpled, crinkled up. Mm-hmm. And like, you're so used to seeing these superhero suits like form fit. So it's like a little odd to see, but it also does make it feel like real in some way.
Yeah, like lived in a little bit.
Yeah, so I don't know. I mean, there's a lot to be said, but yeah, I didn't have very strong feelings, and I don't know if that's a problem, but that was sort of where I landed on it.
Yeah, I mean, you said there's a lot to be said. I really don't have a lot to say about this image, and I thought I was going to, because I've been a big Superman fan for really my whole life. Well, I don't know. There are much, much bigger Superman fans out there than I am. But I, like, grew up, you know, loving the Christopher Reeve movies, and then I watched Lois and Clark, The New Adventures of Superman with
Terry Hatcher
and Dean Cain. Wow. Yeah, when that was on. And caught that in reruns a bunch of times. I watched Smallville all the way through. And so I've liked Superman as a character for a long time. Obviously the Snyder movies have kind of put me off of the character a little bit, because that's been all we've had, really. I know there's been like some animated series and stuff like that I've not really dipped into.
And Superman and Lois on the CW, which is about to wrap up.
Yeah. CW stuff I did not tap into for that most recent show either. But anyway, point being, like, I have a history for this character and liking this character and all that. And I kind of felt the same as you. I was just like, huh, okay, well, like, that's an image, all right. Like, that's a guy in a Superman suit. So,
but I also think that could speak to the idea of sort of what we're talking about with, like, superhero movies no longer being this reliable thing that they once were. And I think, like, you know, 11 years ago, Jeremy Mathai pointed this out in our Slack, slash film writer Jeremy Mathai, that, yeah, that was like in 2011 when Zack Snyder revealed the first look at Henry Cavill in costume. And, like, that's a long time ago, you know. Yeah. And so, you know, we were all feeling very differently. That was only a few years after Iron Man came out. That was only a few years after The Dark Knight came out. It's very worlds away from where we're at now. So we're all kind of used to this stuff. You know, we've had several Supermen since then. And, you know, so, yeah, I don't know. But I can't emphasize that at the end of the day, I just remember when they announced Guardians of the Galaxy and I was like, what are they doing? Why am I not getting a Doctor Strange movie? What is this shit with a talking tree? You know, and then Guardians of the Galaxy remains one of my favorite superhero movies of all time. So, like, you know, that first Suicide Squad movie was terrible. The Suicide Squad is awesome. So I think, like, I have so much faith in James Gunn. Like, and the one interesting thing is he did point out that there's that sky beam sort of behind Clark in the photo. Mm-hmm. Apparently that was all captured in camera. That's not CG. So, well, I don't know
I think you can still say it's CG, but like I would imagine it would still be like an LED wall or something behind them, you know, with CG elements added to it or whatever. But like,
oh, the sure, but
image itself is.
But yeah, but the idea that was captured, like, that's not some post-production thing is kind of cool.
Yeah.
Like, so that's interesting, you know, like, because the idea, I think we all got a little exhausted with some of the, like, over CG'd stuff and the, you know, so I don't know. And like, a lot of people pointed out the image. It's like, there were a lot of jokes, like, you know, like, there's clearly, like, Metropolis is in peril and Clark's just sort of slowly putting on his boots. Yeah. You know, it's like, is that going to be part of the take? Like, is it like, you know, because this is a world where superheroes already exist. Like, is he already a little like, all right, Superman's my job. Like, I don't know if that's what it is, but that would be like an interesting way to approach it, perhaps. I'm not sure.
Yeah, it's from everything James Gunn has been saying, it seems like he'll be a little bit more like optimistic, get up and go than that. But, you know, we'll have to wait and see. I'm just so curious, especially after something like The Fall Guy just does not really work in its opening weekend. And we've seen, you know, these other projects that Hollywood has been releasing not really work to the level that, you know, the industry really needs them to. Are people going to really show up for a Superman movie in 2025? Like, does it have the same cultural cachet that it once did? Is it a reliable thing in the same way that, you know, it has been in years prior? So I just, like, so curious to see.
Well, I think the thing we're seeing is that good superhero movies, and look, I'm not here to, when I say good, I mean, if you were to poll 1,000 people like, you know, like, I think good superhero movies are still breaking through in some way. And I also think, even though, like, it's something like Black Adam that made almost $400 million worldwide, if you can get those budgets down, there's still an audience there. So I think and I know it's hard for a movie like that, but it's not impossible. So I think that's something I would look at. You know, like, there's talk of making a Swamp Thing movie or some of this stuff. You can't make that for $200 million, but there's maybe an audience for that. So I think, like, depending, you know, as long as they don't overspend on Superman, I think this relaunch of the DCU, the excitement around James Gunn, some of this stuff, if you get a good trailer, it can totally, you know, I could see it getting to like 500 worldwide or something, but you've got, you know, it's gotta, under the right circumstances. So I'm curious, we'll see. I mean it makes it feel real. We've talked about this for a long time. It's, you know, the first new solo Superman movie in over a decade, so that's not nothing.
Mm-hmm. So speaking of superheroes, Bob Iger over at Disney has mentioned basically in a new interview or a new a presentation of some sort, he was talking about his plans for Marvel. And he's sort of alluded to this in the past, but now he's sort of put a finer point on it. And he basically says that the new mission at Marvel is to drop the number of Marvel TV shows to 2 a year and the film output to no more than 3 movies a year. His quote is, "We're slowly going to decrease volume and go to probably about 2 TV series a year instead of what had become 4, and reduce our film output from maybe 4 a year to 2 or a maximum of 3. We're working hard on what that path is." This was on an earnings call. He also says, "We have a couple of good films in 2025, and then we're headed to more Avengers, which we're extremely excited about. Overall, I feel great about the slate. It's something that I've committed to spending more and more time on. The team is one that I have tremendous confidence in, and the IP that we're mining, including all the sequels that we're doing, is second to none." So a lot of that is just sort of like typical CEO talk. But yeah, I mean, a couple of good films in 2025 and then on to more Avengers does not necessarily... I don't know. I mean, I guess the only Disney Marvel movie that's coming out this year is Deadpool and Wolverine. The fact that he didn't really mention that seems interesting. But I don't know. What do you make of this sort of like putting a number on what we've sort of suspected has been coming for a little while, Ryan?
Yeah, but that's the thing. We've known this is coming. I think the TV shows is the big thing, right? Like, you're like, look, 2, maybe 3. That's it. And I think that, look, I know that there are pessimistic ways to look at this stuff, but like, at least a studio like Disney is taking the lesson, right? Like, okay, we got to start taking what the audience will give us, and hopefully we can win them back, because they just oversaturated people and they know they did. Mm-hmm. And I hope they learn that with, I hope they take that into account with Star Wars as well. But yeah, like, I think that it's smart. Like, I don't know. I mean, you know, because right now I'm looking at the calendar. You've got Captain America, Thunderbolts, Fantastic Four, and Blade all on the calendar next year. So there's no way Blade sticks. Mm-hmm. You know, so one of those gets bumped, and I don't know. We'll see. But yeah, I think it's smart. Like, you can't. And again, 2, maximum of 3, because we got used to like 3 a year was the thing for a while. Mm-hmm. And so I think some people were like, well, 3 is what they were doing. I'm like, well, he's saying maximum of 3. Like, so I think that, like, you don't dare go over that, you know? And so, and I also think the bigger thing is, in between that, you're not going to have 4 shows to keep up with. And I bet you anything, any shows that are in development now are like, this is in addition to, and you better not have to watch this, you know? And I'm betting that they're making that, you know, more of a thing. So look, we'll see. But I think that, like, at least they're trying to sort of take the lesson of, okay, we overdid it, understood, you know, like, it, and not just trying to figure out how they can somehow cram more in. So I appreciate that, at least.
I do too. And he mentioned something about like the previous, I guess, administrations, which technically was under him too. I mean, like, when Disney Plus came out, it was, people forget that, like, people like to throw Bob Chapek under the bus for ramping this stuff up. But Iger, you know, started turning the dial up himself before he left. And then obviously he returned as Disney CEO. But his quote was like, the company is moving away from, quote, a vestige, basically a desire in the past to increase volume. And I think he referred to like some of the TV shows that are still sitting there as that. And so that makes me wonder if, like, Ironheart, which has been maybe finished, I don't know, like, sitting there for a
long
time.
It's been done. It finished filming, I think, in November 2022.
Yeah. So, like, when are we going to see that? Are they going to, like, because now that they're only going to put out a couple shows a year, are they going to, like, go back in and, like, make that the best they can? Are they, like, pot committed to the point where they have to release that, and they have to, like, spend so much more to get, because you're at that point, you're in such a danger zone if you're Disney and Marvel right now of, like, okay, yeah, we're going to slow things down. But if we slow things down and release bad stuff or things that, you know, we're not as confident in now as we were in that sort of go, go, go period. Now that everyone has shown, like, hey, we really need this stuff to be great, to get people to care, can they weather the storm of releasing a handful of things, whether it be, you know, Ironheart or like the Agatha show or something that, you know, if that stuff is not like top tier material, will people just turn off even further? And then will it be even more difficult to get people to come back to the stuff that eventually ends up being good? And to be clear, I have no idea about the quality of those shows. I'm just presenting like a what if scenario here. So I don't know, just a lot to think about when it comes to this stuff, but
yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I wanted to mention before we take a break, a couple of stories real quick. The new Exorcist movie has lined up one of the best horror directors working right now. I wonder if you can tell me about that.
Yeah, so, and look, I don't want to overstate the point yet, because usually once you hear someone is in talks, it's pretty much a done deal. But Mike Flanagan of The Haunting of Hill House, Dr. Sleep, I know I'm forgetting stuff right now, but one of the most respected names in horror right now is supposedly going to direct this next Exorcist movie. Now, if you recall, last year's The Exorcist Believer was supposed to kick off a new trilogy that Universal is obligated to make because of the deal they made with Morgan Creek. They spent a fortune to get the rights to this thing, and they now, so Exorcist Believer did fine-ish on its own as a movie. If you look at like that, the budget for it was $30 million. It made like $130 million worldwide. But the problem is Universal made like a $400 million deal for this whole trilogy. So they're moving away from David Gordon Green, who directed the last one, and supposedly Flanagan's coming in to do this next one.
I mean, that's gotta be good news for horror fans, right?
Yeah, I'm very intrigued by it because Flanagan is one of those guys horror wise could probably do, like, for a while I've hoped, if not suspected, because that Wes Craven's estate for a while was talking about trying to get a new Nightmare on Elm Street movie done. They were talking about taking pitches, and I thought he was one of the few guys that could maybe go in there and get that going like immediately. And, you know, he's talked about he's doing a Dark Tower thing, supposedly. Like, he's got other stuff and irons in the fire. My thing here is, and I'm not the only person to point this out, is I get why this Exorcist movie needs Mike Flanagan. Why the hell does Mike Flanagan need to do this? Like, what does he get out of this other than a paycheck, of course? Like, is it even worth him taking this on? Like, you're walking into a mess. You know, so I don't know, like, that part of it intrigues me. But the idea of, like, if you just said blindly divorced of everything else, Mike Flanagan is making an Exorcist movie, I'm very interested, of course. But yeah, I think that him walking into the situation as it exists, hard for me to understand how this happened.
I wonder if the original plan, and this is pure speculation on my part, and maybe you know a little bit more about this, maybe you've read a little bit more if they've released any of this information. I wonder if the original plan might have been for a trilogy to be thematically connected or narratively linked or whatever, and then maybe now that the first movie did okay, like you said, but didn't really light the box office on fire, maybe they're bringing Flanagan in to just do something totally different, and like, they are going to release three of these movies, but it's going to have more of like an anthology feel or something.
I think there's no question that that's what they're going to do, because they weren't initially obligated, my understanding is they weren't obligated to tell a specific story in that trilogy. They were just out. So they might bring a character back or whatever, because the other problem is that Exorcist Believer, not well received at all. So, like, yeah, you know, your bigger problem there is, how do you get people interested in a sequel to a movie they might not have liked? So again, that's why I understand why Universal goes to Flanagan and goes, please. but like, yeah, why does he say yes? And that's what's got me curious.
Yeah, I hope the answer is because he has like a really personal connection to this franchise and like a story that he feels like is perfect for this universe or something.
I don't think he's made a bad movie. Like, I don't, you know what I mean? Like, if you look at it, and I mean, especially, I never watched Bly Manor, but I watched, you know, Haunting of Hill House, and boy, do I love Midnight Mass. Like, that is some stellar stuff right there. Like, I'm not even a big vampire guy, but if you haven't watched Midnight Mass, my God. So yeah, I mean, like, again, it's, I go back and forth on this where I just like, did he just have a good idea? Did he go to them? You know, like,
yeah, I don't know.
So this intrigue, but again, he's not signed on the dotted line yet. So we'll see. But, okay. Yeah.
All right, so back in February, Ryan, we talked about Travis Knight potentially taking over as the director of the long-in-the-works live-action Masters of the Universe film. And at the time, that project was still looking for a home, and now it has found one. Amazon MGM has saved it from oblivion and will put this movie out in theaters on June 5th, 2026. And Travis Knight is still on board to direct, and Chris Butler, who has worked on some Leica stop-motion animated movies like Paranorman and Kubo and the Two Strings and Missing Link, is now set to write the script. So thoughts on Amazon / MGM being the home for this project?
For me, the bigger thing is the 2026 theatrical release. Like, not even just that it's happening, that it's like they're committed to putting it in theaters. I'm of a couple of minds about this, given everything we've talked about, like box office wise. Like, this feels like old IP chasing to me.
Yep.
Like slightly outdated thinking of like IP is good because people like things. I don't know. Amazon is one of the only companies I could see sort of, because as we've talked about, like even a $200 million budget is a rounding error for that company. But I also don't want them to overinvest in these things and have someone go, wait, what are we doing? You know, like and pull the plug. So I don't know. I still struggle. Because I was never tapped into like the Masters of the Universe stuff that much. Like, I still struggle to understand how this is like a franchise worthy of, because it's there's no way to make a Masters of the Universe movie that isn't wildly expensive. Like, it's just the sets, the CGI, it's going to be really expensive. So I don't know. I struggle to see where there's like a big enough franchise there, but I mean, the amount of money that's already been sunk into this specific version of this movie, that for nothing to have happened, yeah. Something's got to happen eventually, but we'll see.
Yeah, I'm so curious about that, because the project has been in the works since 2007, and reportedly anywhere from $30 to $60 million has already been spent on development. And it's unclear to me whether Mattel spent that money or Netflix, which was working on it for a while.
Well, it's probably a co-production deal, so it's, I'm sure.
But like, Netflix is out now, and so Amazon MGM has it. So like, is Mattel the one that's shouldering all of that budget and sort of incorporating it into the budget of this eventual movie? I don't know.
What I think probably happened, I'm not positive about this, but I think Mattel has eaten what they've eaten cost wise. But I think like, so when you sign with a production partner, there, you know, there's deals like, you know, what, like Legendary has like an 80-20 deal with Warner Brothers for the Doom movies, I think is what it is. So like, you know, Legendary shouldering 80. So whatever that deal is, like Netflix is going, we want your IP, Hasbro's agreeing to do whatever their percentage is. So they've eaten their percentage. And when it changes hands, my understanding is like, well, you are letting the project go. So Netflix said, we invested what we invested. It's not worth it to us. They essentially are eating their end of the cost. Okay. So that's what my understanding of how that works.
Okay. All right, let's take a break. We have more news to talk about right after this.
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient. Comfortable. Ah.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
All right, so this is a big topic, Ryan, and you know we don't really have a ton of time left on the show today, so I guess let's try to breeze through this as quickly as possible. But last week, you wrote an article called A Rival Hollywood Studio Just Offered to Buy Paramount in a Major Shakeup. Since then...
Yeah, I can make this short. Yeah.
Okay, some more information has come out. So give me like sort of like the up-to-the-minute what we know right now of this story.
All right, I'm going to go through this quickly as possible, but mostly what's going to... opens up another topic entirely, but this is why this can be short. So Paramount has kind of been up for sale. It's no secret they designated a special board to field offers a little while ago, essentially because like Paramount is having a tough time competing in the marketplace as it is and blah, blah, blah. So there's been a few offers on the table. Skydance, the company behind like Mission Impossible and the more recent Terminator movies, had a unique deal. I don't understand the full deal, but like there was an odd financing deal and it wasn't super popular with shareholders because they wouldn't make out super well. But Sherry Redstone, whose parent company owns Paramount, was like in favor of that deal. That looks like it's not going to happen. So then what happened is that exclusive window for Skydance negotiations was closing. Sony came in with this private equity firm to offer like $26 billion all cash to buy Paramount, which was a lot more than the Skydance deal. But the rub there was that they were going to take the company private. So Paramount is currently a public company and they were going to try to take it private. That would take the number of studios in Hollywood down from 5 majors to 4. All kinds of regulatory hurdles there. But it doesn't seem, everything I've come to understand is that the Sony deal is not popular within Paramount's walls because they don't want to go private. They don't like private equity. Now it's starting to look like Paramount just might go it alone. Like they might just not take any of these offers. They recently fired CEO Bob Bakish, and now there's like this trio of people heading up other divisions that are sort of CEOing the company. And it seems a little messy, but yeah, it doesn't look like the Sony offer is going to go. And even if they agreed to a deal in principle, getting through regulatory hurdles would seem, to my view, almost impossible. So I don't know. When you and I talked about this a little bit last week, we're like, on the one hand, like, I think Paramount staying alone is better, but I also am concerned about their ability to survive. So I don't know. That's the
question is like, the studio clearly has not been doing great for a while. I mean, there's been,
arguably 20 years.
Yeah. So they've had a rough stretch, to put it mildly. There's just been all this turmoil behind the scenes. And I think like literally books have been written about the business problems and conflicts and things like that behind the scenes with the Redstone family and the ownership of the company and all that kind of stuff. So like, you know, this has been like a long time coming and people have just assumed that, oh, yeah, Paramount's going to get sort of subsumed by some other company or something. But I don't know enough about this, Ryan, but I feel like, yeah, like you mentioned, maybe it is a good thing for them to kind of go it alone. And maybe just like now that they have this sort of three-headed monster of three different people running the company as like a joint CEO, I think they refer to it as like the office of the CEO position.
Yeah, that's what they're calling it. Yeah, yeah.
So maybe those guys who run different divisions, there's like Paramount Pictures and then there's Showtime/MTV Entertainment Studios and CBS. Maybe like those guys putting their heads together can come up with some ways to, I don't know what they would need to do, cut costs, You know, that would certainly happen if there was actually a merger at play. Like, tons and tons of people would lose their jobs.
Yeah. Well, they also need cash is the bigger problem. And part of the problem with Bob Bakish getting fired is he didn't pull the trigger on, he could have sold Showtime. He could have sold BET for like billions of dollars and didn't pull the trigger. And those assets literally decline in value every single day. So yeah. Like, yeah, there's some stuff going on.
So now they're in a tough position of like, do you try to sell this stuff for basically pennies and like just to get something? Or do you try to, I don't know, reorganize the company in such a way and sort of re-strategize in a way? Like, do you think that they should, here's an idea, Ryan. And again, I know nothing about like the inner workings of these companies or whether or not this is even a feasible thing. Do you think they should just like shut the doors on Paramount Plus, for example, right?
I've
like,
said this for months.
Okay, well, we've also said that like the future is streaming and there's no way around that. So for Paramount to remain a viable entity, how could they close their streaming service but also remain, you know, a major player in Hollywood? I don't understand.
You go the Sony route and you become an arms dealer. You know, like you know other people need content. Sony has a pretty lucrative deal with Netflix for output. You know, all of their theatrical movies go to Netflix after their VOD window. Okay. So, you know, I think now the problem is Paramount should have gotten in that arms dealing race a long time ago. Not everyone can be an arms dealer. That's starting to be more attractive as streaming seems. Because my other problem is I don't think Peacock's going to make it either. And I don't know that like the industry, I don't know. I don't know where this all goes. Like it's tricky, but Paramount, I mean, I think the thing is like Paramount or NBC Universal should have pulled the plug on Peacock and or Paramount Plus a while ago. It's beginning to feel sunk cost fallacy here a bit, but, you know, because they're losing billions getting, you know, those businesses up and running. So I don't know. Again, I'm with you. I don't know the inner workings, but I've felt for a while that one of those services needs to die. So we'll see.
Okay. Well, yeah, we'll keep people posted on what happens to Paramount, because it is an important thing. I mean, as we've been talking about over the past few years, like consolidation in the industry seems inevitable to some degree, but like every time a studio gets gobbled up, that's one fewer place for storytellers
it's
to go.
It's one less buyer in the marketplace, which is bad.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so moving on to Netflix's Cobra Kai is going to be concluding with a 3-part final season. So part one is going to be coming to Netflix on July 18th. Part two is going to be split up and arriving on November 28th. And then part three is coming in 2025. I think they've recently announced that Sony's new Karate Kid movie, which stars Jackie Chan and Ralph Macchio, is going to be coming to theaters in May of 2025. So I think that's going to be sort of timed to the release of this final season here. I just wanted to mention that because I know that a lot of people like this show. I have not seen any of it myself. Do you count yourself among the Cobra Kai faithful, Ryan?
I do not. I will only say that my girlfriend got really into the show for a bit, and the bits that I caught, I just remember thinking to myself, this is the show people are obsessed with. It struck me as odd, but again, watching stuff out of context, so I'm not like holding that against the show by any means.
Yeah.
Okay,
go to the article to get those dates again and learn more about that. I just wanted to mention it here on the show. And then Vin Diesel is coming back to the Riddick franchise. I saw Pitch Black years and years and years ago, Ryan, and don't really remember much about it. I remember it being sort of like a down and dirty kind of thing compared to like the slickness of like the Fast and Furious movies, for example.
Oh yeah.
But I have not seen the Chronicles of Riddick or whatever the third film in this franchise was called. That's name is escaping me right now. Was it just
called
Riddick?
Yeah, just called Riddick.
So now he's coming back for a movie called Riddick colon Furia, I think
it's Furia is how you say
Furia, F-U-R-Y-A.
Yeah.
And David Tui is the writer and director. Once again, he's, I believe, written and directed every movie in this franchise. So,
yep.
What are your feelings about the Pitch Black universe, I guess, this franchise, and what do you think about a fourth film?
I quite like Pitch Black and Riddick. I haven't seen Chronicles of Riddick in a very long time, but that was an example of like, you know, like a weird $120 million movie that should have never existed. It like flopped very badly. but famously Vin Diesel to come back to Fast and Furious for that cameo in Tokyo Drift, negotiated to get the rights to this franchise so he could make 2013's Riddick. Like, it's been a huge passion project for him for years. So, you know, it was before the pandemic, they got the script done for this. And then the pandemic happened, so I think that slowed things down. Like, this would have been here a couple of years ago, I think. But yeah, so, I mean, the last one was very successful for a mid-budget movie, and at a time where we could use stuff like that, I'm all for this happening. I did mention in my write-up that Vin Diesel was accused of sexual battery last year. We haven't quite resolved that yet, but the fact that this movie is moving forward is a bit interesting. Diesel has denied those allegations, but it is sort of, I don't want to sweep that under the rug as we're talking about these movies.
Yeah, for sure. But yeah, like a cloud that's hovering over this movie for sure.
It seems to be. Yeah. But again, you mentioned yesterday, I don't know, like, if the studio conducted some independent investigation and determined, you know, I have no idea, but mm-hmm. It is something. But yeah, just taking the movie as a movie, I'd be curious to see where this goes.
Okay. And then last story that I wanted to mention here, our headline says Hollywood's weirdest horror director is making an 80s vampire movie. I'm very excited about this. So the name of the film, I believe, is, what is it called? It's called Flesh of the Gods. And it is the script is from Andrew Kevin Walker, who wrote Seven and The Killer, the David Fincher movies. And Panos Cosmatos is the director of this. He directed Mandy, the Nicolas Cage film that came out in 2018. All right, listen to this, Ryan. So in glittering 80s LA, married couple Raul, played by Oscar Isaac, and Alex, played by Kristen Stewart, descend each evening from their luxury skyscraper condo and head into an electric nighttime realm of 80s Los Angeles. When they cross paths with the mysterious and enigmatic Nameless and her hard-partying cabal, Raul and Alex are seduced into a glamorous, surrealistic world of hedonism, thrills, and violence. And yeah, this is a vampire movie set in 80s Los Angeles. Panos Cosmatos referred to this as a hot rod joyride deep into the glittering heart of hell. So Oscar Isaac, Kristen Stewart, 80s, Panos Cosmatos, LA, like, hell yes, I'm totally in on this. What do you think about this?
Look, this is going to be Film Twitter's favorite movie whenever it comes about, but not to be this guy again, but going back to the beginning of our conversation, like, what works in Hollywood? Well, one thing I've talked about recently is vampires are not working at all. Like, the last, like, three vampire movies that have come out have, you know, bombed or underperformed, and it's been a long time since we've had a breakout vampire movie. So unless this is made for very, very cheap, and given the people who are involved, I don't know that it can be that cheap. Like, I'm personally excited for it, but I'd be curious to see how this sort of shakes out, like, on a longer timeline. Yeah. But, like, look, the guy who made Mandy making a vampire movie with these people, hell yeah. Like, I'm with you. Like, absolutely. Like, to throw some optimism in the gears, absolutely. But it also is just, like, I'm so nervous about everything now, like, just nothing working, that, like, I get, like, pre-nervous about stuff now, where I'm like, oh God, is this going to, like, not work? But yeah, I just really, it's like, you know, thank you, the industry as it currently exists, for destroying my optimism. But as a movie, I'm very excited. So yeah, I'm with
you. I have to assume that this is going to be made for, you know, under $50 million or something like that. So, like, whether or not that can reclaim its budget and all that stuff, let's punt that part of the discussion down the road to when this gets
100%. Yeah.
You know, actually released. And then for right now, Ryan, especially given what we've talked about over the course of this episode, let's just sort of luxuriate in the glory of this announcement and just, like, spend the next year or two hoping that this ends up being, if not, like, a full-blown hit, then certainly, like, a cult classic or something that...
Yeah, but I think that the... Again, I do think, like, this has every piece on the board for people to just, like, yell about this movie. Like, the people that love this movie are gonna, like, they're gonna make it their whole personality. Like, yeah. And I think that's cool. So I'm really, really, really looking forward to this.
Okay, excellent. Well, that's going to do it for today's show. You can find much more about all of these stories that we mentioned on the show at slashfilm.com. I will link to all of them in the show notes as well. Slash Film Daily is published every weekday, bringing you the most exciting news from the world of movies and TV, as well as deeper dives into the great features you can find on the site. You can subscribe to the show on Apple, Overcast, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Send your feedback, questions, comments, concerns, and mailbag topics to us at bpearson@slashfilm.com. Make sure to leave your name and general geographic location in case we mention your email on the air. Don't forget to take a minute to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. That really does help us out a lot. Tell your friends about the show any way you can. Thank you so much for listening, and we will talk to you all tomorrow.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.